Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Engine start and liftoff. Liftoff of SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket carrying 40 internet satellites into orbit for OneWeb.
A small launch for SpaceX and a giant leap for satellite broadband in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 8th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, if you thought Anchorage was done with snow, don't put your shovel away just yet.
Some of them could be seeing about 6 inches coming in Monday into Tuesday.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What if accessing your personal and family immunization records was as easy as checking your phone? The Docket app is a secure option that allows Alaskans to quickly access their immunization records. Need immunization records for school or travel? Docket makes it simple and is available for download from the App Store or Google Play Store. Learn more at vaccinationrecords.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A trial is set to begin next week to determine whether Representative David Eastman's lifetime membership in the extremist Oath Keepers group disqualifies him to serve as a state legislator. A voter named Randall Kowalki filed the legal challenge. It cites a provision in the state constitution that says people cannot hold public office if they belong to an organization that advocates overthrowing the federal government by force or violence. Members of the Oath Keepers were prominent participants in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The group's founder and another leader were recently convicted of seditious conspiracy. Eastman, a Republican from Wasilla, easily won re-election last month, but an order from Superior Court Judge Jack McKenna has prevented the Division of Elections from certifying Eastman's election while the case is pending. The case has implications beyond who will represent District 27. The leadership of the state house is in limbo, and Eastman's fate is one factor making it hard for either faction to organize a majority. McKenna said he'd rule tomorrow on motions to dismiss the case, but said the lawyers should plan to give their opening statements on Monday. A rocket loaded with a cluster of communication satellites lifted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida at 1:27 Alaska time. They're part of OneWeb's efforts to create a worldwide network of low Earth orbit, or LEO, satellites. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, OneWeb already serves a few communities in Alaska and hopes to add many more.
2 minutes, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
These launches are not so unusual anymore. SpaceX has about one a week. But what is unusual is the payload.
Engine start and liftoff. Liftoff of SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket carrying 40 internet satellites into orbit for OneWeb. Beautiful launch at sunset here from Kennedy Space Center.
The Falcon 9 carried OneWeb's largest number of satellites ever for one launch, which will help the company grow its constellation of LEO satellites to about 500. Katie Dowd represents OneWeb's North America operations. As she toured Launch Pad 39 before takeoff, she said she was overcome with emotion when she realized it was the same one used to send the first men to the moon.
Gives you chills, honestly, just imagining how many incredible groundbreaking moments have transpired here. And then you get to look at the rocket as it's standing up vertically, knowing our satellites are at the top.
Each is about the size of a washing machine.
Think about the satellites as ornaments you might hang on your Christmas tree. So we start at the bottom and you hang satellites around the tree, and then you continue to hang them next to one another around the whole circle until you get to the top.
SpaceX, which is also building a LEO network for its Starlink company, is kind of in competition with OneWeb, but they serve different markets. While Starlink caters to consumers, OneWeb serves internet providers like ACS, which has already utilized OneWeb's network to bring broadband service to the Southwest Alaska communities of Akiak and the Lower Yukon.
Today's launch will allow us to not only strengthen the service we're delivering in communities like Akiak, but also expand coverage and provide services to more communities like that across the U.S. and around the world.
Chris Cropley, who oversees the Tlingit and Haida Council's broadband program, is excited about OneWeb's expansion. He says it puts yet another tool in the toolbox to serve tribal communities. He says he's a big fan of fiber optic cable, but it's just not the silver bullet.
It's going to take more billions of dollars than are in the entire federal budget to bring fiber to everybody, where with satellites, they can bring broadband to the world.
Cropley says, even so, it's going to take a combination of companies like GCI, which provides fiber optic cable service throughout Alaska, along with LEO networks to meet all the needs, because Southeast Alaska is geographically one of the most challenging places in the country to provide broadband.
If you had one restaurant in town, no matter how good it was, it's not going to serve everyone. So it brings much needed competition, diversity, and options.
One of the benefits of low Earth orbit satellites is that it's a much quicker process to connect communities. Liesl McGuire, a former state lawmaker who now represents OneWeb in Alaska, says it will bring empowerment to communities that have in the past been left behind. And it also comes at a time when broadband access is more important than ever to rural Alaskans.
On our coastlines, where we have some of the first climate change refugees, you have people doing very sensitive climate change data research, and it's imperative that they're able to get that up and down.
For rural Alaskans, LEO networks can potentially provide internet access on boats or moose hunting camps, even on airplanes. OneWeb says it hopes to launch a mobile service next year. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Anchorage residents are still shoveling out of a massive snowstorm that hit Tuesday and continued into Wednesday, stranding some cars and closing schools for 2 days. More than 2 feet of snow fell in some parts of town. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, it's Anchorage's heaviest December snowstorm in more than 20 years.
The National Weather Service says this week's snowstorm broke at least one record. Anchorage on Tuesday recorded its largest single-day snowfall for December 6th, with about 10.4 inches of new snow at the official measuring site at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. Meteorologist Michael Cutts says the snowfall actually started on Monday, when the remnants of a low-pressure system coming up from the Gulf of Alaska brought a little under 2 inches of snow.
But quick on the heels was a larger area being pushed by a low that was further up north. And that low was the one that brought us the record snowfall.
However, when Cutts says record, he means a record amount of snowfall for that specific day, December 6th. Cutts says it wasn't close to breaking any records for snowfall on any day during Anchorage's lengthy winter.
Believe it or not, it didn't even break the top 10, even in December.
But the storm is still notable for the month of December, says fellow Weather Service meteorologist Brian Brettschneider. He says Tuesday was not only Anchorage's snowiest December 6th, but also ranks as the city's fifth highest single-day snowfall in December.
The only ones that are larger actually were consecutive days in 1955, which was our biggest snowstorm on record.
As for that multi-day storm as a whole, it's Anchorage's biggest December snowstorm since the late 90s. Brettschneider says while the storm dropped more than 10 inches of snow at the airport, other parts of town saw more than double that.
I had 20 inches, and I'm by the Fred Meyer on Abbott. Just up past service high, coworker had 25 inches. This is one of those cases where the airport really was the lowest snowfall around town. That doesn't usually happen, actually.
Brettschneider says the fact that the Anchorage School District closed schools 2 days in a row further illustrates the scale of the storm. And road crews are still catching up. Trucks continue to clear piles of wet, heavy snow off city streets that dozens of cars got stuck in on Wednesday. Cutts says Anchorage should get some relief from snowfall over the next couple days, but the forecast calls for plummeting temperatures.
In the interim, we're going to be dealing with some colder temperatures here on the west side of town, generally 0 to 5 above. Over on the east side, could get as low as 15 below. and that is also extends up towards the Eagle River area.
But the snow-free skies won't last. Kutz says clouds are set to form Saturday night, with snowfall starting back up as early as Sunday.
We're still juggling with the numbers because we're getting some conflicting data coming through from the models. Some of them could be seeing about 6 inches. Coming in Monday into Tuesday.
If you're one of the Anchorage residents who's put off shoveling your driveway, Kutz says it's probably best to get that taken care of by Saturday. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Coming up, new evidence shows a historic climb of Denali was more than just a tall tale.
Marvelous sort of insight into an event that has been revered by some climbers and doubted by others for 110 years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance? United Way Healthcare Navigators are here to help you understand your new Affordable Care Act coverage options and opportunity for savings. You can call 211 or text Get Covered AK to 898-211 to connect to a healthcare navigator. Enrollment is open now through January 15th. Call 211 today. This message sponsored by United Way of Anchorage.
Low birth rates are likely contributing to the decline in the population of beluga whales in Cook Inlet, according to a study published this week. Gina Himes-Bohr is a research professor in the ecology department at Montana State University and the lead author on the study. She says this is the first time researchers have been able to estimate birth rates for the species, and she says those lower than expected rates are likely a big factor in the population's overall downfall.
Getting that demographic piece in place and understanding that helps us to get closer to identifying what might be sort of the external factors that are limiting their recovery.
The study is the latest piece in a puzzle scientists are trying to solve about why Cook Inlet belugas are not rebounding as a population. Himes-Bohr and her team used photos of individual belugas to chart trends in the population as a whole. And what they found was whales were not giving birth at rates they would expect from healthier populations. She says while belugas in healthy populations give birth every 2 to 3 years, Cook Inlet belugas reproduced every 4 years. Rebecca Taylor from the Alaska Science Center was another author on the study. She says researchers also used the photo data to measure survival rates in the population, which they also found were lower than expected.
It is really important to understand birth and death rates for endangered populations like the Cook Inlet belugas.
Himes-Bohr says the next step in research will be pinning down the specific factors contributing to low beluga birth rates and higher death rates.
Because this population is declining and, you know, its prospects aren't looking great.
Himes-Bohr says in the next year, researchers will look at data that extends through 2022. December is chock full of events that bring small towns together. But this holiday season, a number of groups in Petersburg are also getting excited about a pragmatic gift from the borough. It's a machine about the size of a refrigerator. And as KFSK's Rachel Cassandra reports, the machine promises to help with the child care crisis, the police department, and the labor shortage.
Police Chief James Kerr is opening the first box from a huge pile in a side room at the police station.
Let's see. That's electronic signature pad.
He's checking parts of his master list of components.
These are a lot bigger boxes than I was expecting.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, I guess I just had no idea how big a fingerprint machine would be. So what is the printer for? Does that print?
That'll print out, so when people come in and they want to take the cards with them, it'll print out all their fingerprint cards.
Oh, okay.
The machine is a LiveScan 1000, an electronic fingerprint machine. It cost the borough just under $22,000. The borough used ARPA grant money, which is federal funding for COVID relief. But the police department wasn't the first to request the LiveScan 1000. Chelsea Tremblay heads the borough's Early Childhood Education Task Force. She says it's been hard for childcare facilities to hire new people.
Fingerprinting is a part of the background process, and the process for getting fingerprints done here in town was slow and frustrating.
In the past, applicants would get fingerprinted at the police station the old-fashioned way, with ink and paper. Then applicants had to mail in those fingerprint cards to whatever office is processing their paperwork.
There are a lot of reasons why people need to get fingerprints done. Sometimes it's for a job, sometimes it's for a different kind of application.
Charlay Mamoui runs Petersburg's Children's Center. She says fingerprinting is required when they're hiring people.
We are bound by state licensing regulations, and state licensing regulations says that the person that we hire has to be of sound mind and body and criminal history.
The biggest hitch comes when those cards aren't done correctly. And Mamoui says it's harder to do than you might think.
It's not like you just can slap your fingerprints onto a card and just call it good. And when they do come back smudged, we won't know about that until after they've been rejected from the state.
Chief Kerr says that fingerprint cards are rejected all the time.
It might look good to us, but it didn't meet the quality that they needed. And this thing will tell us right away.
And Mamoui says the Children's Center has actually lost applicants because of how long the process was taking.
Sometimes they already have other better paying jobs, and sometimes they're just like, oh, this is taking forever. I really don't want to. I found something different or whatever it may be.
The machine also has the potential to allow Petersburg residents to get more creative about solving the childcare crisis. Tremblay says the Early Childhood Education Task Force is trying to do just that.
For example, we were brainstorming, how cool would it be to be able to have a volunteer network of people that could be extra bodies in a room at a childcare center when they need them? Even that idea was running into this roadblock.
Chief Kerr walks me out to the garage to the metal cabinet that will hold the machine. Kerr says the machine will also be able to compare fingerprints to national electronic records.
If we have someone who's refusing to tell us who they are, and they get arrested, we enter them in as John Doe or Jane Doe, and we should have results back within an hour or so. It's something that I think the community's needed for a long time. Yeah, I can't wait to get this thing installed. Now we gotta put it together.
Yeah.
Borough manager Steve Giesbrecht worked with the chief on the machine's purchase. He says in the future, Petersburg may be able to use the machine to jump through even more bureaucratic hoops. Applicants could use it to apply for TSA PreCheck or to get their TWIC cards. That stands for Transportation Worker Identity Credential. Those cards are necessary for workers who need higher security clearance for maritime facilities and vessels. Tremblay says it's especially cool that this single piece of technology will impact so many different groups in Petersburg.
This is something that really touches a lot of people's lives, but they don't know it until it's about to impact them, and then it's very frustrating. So it feels really good that this broad group of people were able to collectively identify this as something that was really frustrating, and then we had the funds available, we had staff interested in pursuing it, taking it seriously, and now we have a solution.
The police department is waiting for one more part for the machine. Then HID Global, who makes the machine, will install it. The company will also train officers in the police department on how to take fingerprints. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
The Petersburg Police Department does not have a firm timeline on how long the Postal Service installation and training will take. Until then, Petersburg will rely on ink and paper.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production, and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP-Ed.
In order for emergency responders to arrive quickly to the scene of an accident, they need to live nearby. But in Cooper Landing, a lack of affordable housing is driving volunteers out of town and leaving the community with a drought of responders. KDLL's Riley Board reports.
Paramedic Clay Adam came to Cooper Landing in 2019. He moved from Houston, Texas, where he managed one of the busiest trauma centers in the country. Although he left behind the pressure of that job, he inherited a new stressor as the Cooper Landing EMS chief, having enough people to adequately respond to emergencies across hundreds of square miles of land and 70 miles of highways.
That level of stress, worrying about every time those tones go off, are you going to have enough people? And it does create a lot of stress.
In the central Kenai Peninsula community of close to 400, the only emergency response station is the nonprofit, volunteer-based Cooper Landing Emergency Services. The department runs off community donations of both money and time in order to respond to car accidents, fires, and other emergencies in the town, more than 45 minutes from the closest borough-managed fire station. But volunteers are in short supply. Adam says it's because Cooper Landing has struggled with providing the affordable housing necessary to retain CLES volunteers, most of them young families looking to rent. Adam says most of the options for those who can't afford a house are dry cabins, meaning lodging without running water, that go for $1,000 a month. Many small properties are designated as short-term rentals like Airbnb and Vrbo, unavailable to long-term renters. And even if the volunteers could afford to buy, Adam says 50% of the land in town is owned by trusts. One of the only rental options in town, a four-unit multifamily building, previously housed several CLES volunteers. But last year, flooding caused a well contamination, and this February, the property owner evicted all of the residents. CLES lost 8 volunteers, basically overnight. Rachel Mundy is one of the volunteers who got evicted from that apartment building.
It was super run down and full of mold and nothing worked and the oven didn't work. You know, it was awful, but we were so happy to get it.
Mundy says most of the housing options in town are extremely pricey, or they're worker housing for employees of local businesses, most of which close during the winter anyway. After being evicted from the apartment building, she moved into an RV with her husband, also a volunteer, and her baby, and they lived in the parking lot of the CLES station. Now she lives in Sterling and sleeps at a friend's house in Cooper Landing a few nights a week so she can be on call for the station. When she's home in Sterling, sometimes an ambulance from Central Emergency Services passes by her house, and she feels powerless.
Had I been in Cooper Landing, I could have responded. You know, you work so hard to make sure that you keep a community safe or that you're doing your part. And then it's like, I can't do it anymore. And it wasn't my choice.
This winter, CLES has 18 active volunteers, down from an ideal 25 to 30. But 4 are traveling out of the state right now, and most of the remaining volunteers work during the day and aren't available.
If I got a call right this minute, I would probably have 4 to 6 people able to respond immediately.
But the average number of responders needed for an EMS call is 4, meaning if more than one incident happens at the same time, CLES would be in trouble. And for fires, the number of responders needed is an unachievable 8 to 10. Adam, the only paramedic at the station, is afraid to leave Cooper Landing, knowing his skills could be needed at any time.
So I literally do not leave town unless I absolutely have to.
At these unsustainably low levels of volunteers, CLES is looking forward to some changes that might help. More than half of the CLES volunteers are moms. To help out those families, the department is starting an auxiliary volunteer program where community members can volunteer to babysit the children or feed the pets of volunteers while they're on call. CLES is also considering becoming a formal service area within the borough to ease the financial pressures and volunteer shortages. This would involve creating a service area board and receiving a budget from taxes.
The community sort of has to decide, right? Either they're not going to have any responders because the responders can't afford to be here, or they can become a service area. Yes, they have to pay taxes, but then they'll have someone if they get hurt or if they're choking or if they have a heart attack.
When it comes to housing, Adam says Cooper Landing needs more affordable housing, and fast, to keep the community protected. On the Kenai Peninsula, I'm Riley Board.
There's new proof of the success of a pioneering ascent of Denali. Historic photographs from the 1910 sourdough expedition were located this fall at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The black and white images provide hard copy evidence that Alaskans Pete Anderson, Billy Taylor, Charlie McGonigal, and Tom Lloyd, known as the Sourdough Expedition, got members to the top of Denali's 19,400-foot North Peak in April 1910, a feat long the subject of skepticism.
They went, they did the climb, but they were not good about documenting it.
University of Alaska Fairbanks geophysics professor Matthew Sturm says he came across the Sourdough Expedition photos in October while doing research for an unrelated mountaineering book at the UAF Rasmussen Library Archive. He says he was looking through a box of materials and found a folder with a label that included the words 1911 McKinley Climb. He says despite the date being off by a year,
I got a tingly sense that maybe something good could come of this.
Sturm says one of the photos shows two climbers he immediately recognized.
I'm a bit of an amateur history buff for climbing in Alaska and Yukon. I thought, whoa, that's Charlie McGonigal and Pete Anderson from the Sourdough Climb.
Sturm says he worked with University of Alaska Fairbanks Archive and Museum of the North staff to confirm the identities of the pictured sourdough climbers, including Taylor and Anderson, who he says made it to the North Peak summit. He says he figured out where the photos were taken by comparing them with modern images of the mountain.
We could place them quite high on the route. The highest one is sometime near around 16,000, where we've never been able to place them anywhere near that before. Marvelous sort of insight into an event that has been revered by some climbers and doubted by others for 110 years.
Sturm says the photos add to another piece of evidence that the Sourdough Expedition climbed Denali's North Peak, a spruce flagpole the climbers set up a little below the summit, which was reported seen by members of the 1913 Hudson Stuck Expedition, the first to reach the top of Denali's higher South Peak.
Validates the stories and interviews we have from them. So I think it moves it from shadowy, maybe it did or didn't happen, I think, right into the mainstream. It happened.
Sturm says the Sourdough Expedition photos were donated to the UAF archive in the 1980s by the daughter of an early 1900s Fairbanks newspaper editor who was friends with Sourdough Expedition climber Billy Taylor.
She donated a lot of stuff to the archives, and they logged it in. It would have taken an expert to know what it was.
He says it remains a mystery why the photos weren't used by expedition members to prove their summit claim. Sturm plans to write an article for a mountaineering journal about the photos. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rhonda McBride and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks and Riley Board in Kenai, Rachel Cassandra in Petersburg, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 45 years of Alaska operations. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
And by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.